In a world full of lies and deception, it takes courage to speak truth. In a nation half-bent on its own destruction, it takes honor to seek a return to glory. Join us in cutting through the lies and propaganda. It's time for Cutting Through the Chaos on the America Out Loud Network. Here is your host, Wallace Garneau.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Cutting Through the Chaos on the America Out Loud Network, where we cut through the lies and the propaganda to bring you the out loud truth. I'm your host, Wallace Garneau, and we've got a great show for you today. We're going to talk about two important topics, very tightly related. First, I want to talk about the myth of the Southern strategy. And then at the second part of the show, I want to talk about what I call American apartheid, which is really the war on poverty, real systemic racism in America today. I think we talk about the myth of the Southern strategy first and then talk about American apartheid next. I think it'll flow together very nicely. I guarantee you'll learn some things. And everything that I am ever going, that I'm going to say in this episode, every single bit of it is absolutely true. For those of you who don't know what the Southern strategy is, it's the reason why Democrats like to call all things Republican racist, which is interesting that they do because, you know, everything that has been, you know, the real racism in this country, you go back to slavery, you go back to Jim Crow and all of that, that was all driven by the Democrat Party. As a matter of fact, if you look at the Civil War, the Civil War could be just as easily said to have been fought between the Democrats in the South and the Republicans in the North as between the North and the South. Because the Democrats who were in the North were in favor of slavery, and the Republicans in the South were against slavery. It was very, very much a war between the Republican and Democrat parties. And in fact, the beginning of both the Democrat and Republican parties, they both split off of Thomas Jefferson's Democratic Republicans. The Democrats broke off of that in order to perpetuate slavery by allowing it to spread to additional states as the nation expanded. And the Republicans broke off specifically to prevent slavery from spreading to additional states as the nation expanded. That was a very important thing, whether or not we should expand slavery. When you go all the way back to the founding of the country in 1789, because that's when the Constitution was ratified. Obviously, 1776 is the country's birth date, but 1789 is the Constitutional Republic's birth date. So if you go all the way back to the beginning of our Constitutional Republic, the Supreme Court has the three-fifths clause, which says that a slave is to be considered for the purpose of the census, the U.S. Census, in terms of how many people the House of Representatives get from each state to be considered three-fifths of a person. That's a very, very misunderstood clause of the Constitution. Today, people use that and they will say that the purpose of this was to make African Americans only three-fifths of a man. The truth is that there was a tremendous compromise reached between whether or not slaves should be counted toward the percentage of the population or the number of people that a state has in relation to how many representatives they get in the House of Representatives or not. You know, the people that did not want slavery at the outset of our country did not want slaves counted toward the House of Representatives because all the slaves were in slaveholding states. And they said, well, if we do that, that gives the slaveholding states more power. They've already got a lot of people. That gives them more power than if we do not count the slaves toward the number of representatives in the House of Representatives. The slaveholding states, conversely, they looked at it and they said, now, wait a minute. If we do what those people in the North, the non-slaveholding states, want, and we don't count the slaves when we look at the number of people in each state, there's a lot of slaves in our states. That's going to give the people that want to end slavery a tremendous amount of power over us. So the three-fifths compromise was really designed in order to allow the Constitution to pass because the Southern states were not going to pass unless they got representation in the House of Representatives based on slaves who were not allowed to vote. And the Northern states were not going to ratify the Constitution unless they had the power based upon having a larger population that didn't include slaves. So they compromised, they reached an agreement, and they were able to ratify the Constitution. Neither side, by the way, liked the three-fifths compromise. Those that wanted to abolish slavery wanted the power to do so. Those that wanted to preserve slavery wanted the power to do so. It was a compromise they reached to ratify the Constitution. So right out of the gate, we have, it doesn't refer to race in the Three-Fifths Compromise. It simply refers to slaveholding states and non-slaveholding states and how slaves will be counted toward how many members of the House of Representatives each state gets. It's also important because the number of members of the House of Representatives you have, plus your two senators, that determines how many electors a state gets for the Electoral College. So that's how it started out. Eventually, the Democratic Republicans of Thomas Jefferson broke apart into the Democrat and Republican parties. And that's how we got the two parties that we have today. They were literally both initially single issue parties related around the issue of slavery, with Republicans wanting to initially not expand slavery into additional states, and Democrats wanting to expand slavery into additional states. And that was important because every time you add a state, they get members in the House of Representatives, they get senators. So you get the power balance between the North and the South, the slaveholding and non-slaveholding states, was something that if one side got too much power, either slavery would expand or slavery would be abolished, and everybody knew it. So every time a state was added, there was always this debate. Is it going to allow slavery? Is it not going to allow slavery? There are all kinds of compromises, all kinds of things that the North and the South did, the slave and non-slaveholding states did, in order to try to hold the country together over this single issue of slavery. So we all know what happened after that. Eventually, we had all the compromises. The country continued to expand. Some of the states were slaveholding. Some of the states were not. You had bloody Kansas, where whether or not Kansas was going to become a slave or a free state was highly contested with raiding parties. Essentially, there was a little bit of a war in Kansas between the two sides, and that led us into the Civil War. Well, after the Civil War, slavery was abolished, and the 13th and 14th Amendments were ratified, the 13th abolishing slavery, and the 14th essentially saying that all citizens of the United States have to be treated equally under the law. So equal treatment under the law, irrespective of race or various other factors. And so if you look at the 14th Amendment and read the 14th Amendment, and then you read the Civil Rights Act that didn't occur until the 1960s, you will see very, very quickly that the Civil Rights Act did nothing more than to force the issue of whether or not we would truly use the 14th Amendment. See, after the 14th Amendment was ratified, Democrats in the Supreme Court immediately misinterpreted it in order to take the teeth out of it and to say things like, well, separate but equal is still legal. That's you know, so they played hanky-panky there with their interpretation of the Constitution, which tells you how far back interpreting the Constitution incorrectly goes, making a political interpretation of the Constitution rather than trying to interpret it based upon what it really says, an originalist interpretation. That shows you just how far back that goes. It goes all the way back, at least to the 14th Amendment. Really, it goes all the way back to Alexander Hamilton, who was a staunch supporter of the Constitution right up until it passed, and then decided that in spite of the 10th Amendment specifically saying exactly the opposite, that the federal government should have any power not specifically barred it by the Constitution, minus the 10th Amendment in his opinion, and so it should be able to do anything that it wants unless it's expressly said, told it can't do that by the Constitution, and he wasn't including the 10th Amendment. So then what we had is we had the Democrats in the South. They created kind of a paramilitary called the Ku Klux Klan. And the Ku Klux Klan, in addition to trying to terrorize African-Americans in the South, they also terrorized Republicans in the South because the Republicans were trying to educate and trying to help black people vote and trying to go from just the end of slavery to integrating them fully into our society, which is something that the Democrats could not stand for. So the KKK was formed in order to quash those efforts, in order to terrorize and harass African Americans, primarily in the South. The KKK's growth in the North came later. And that was the way that it was then for a long time. The NRA, a lot of people don't know this. There's a myth that the NRA was founded in order to help African Americans arm themselves to protect themselves from the KKK. That's not true. The NRA was founded as a sportsman's club to safely utilize firearms, to teach children how to use firearms and these sorts of things. However, NRA groups in the South did arm the African Americans, or try to arm, they worked on arming African Americans in order to help them defend themselves against the KKK. So it's really a true story. And then, of course, the struggle to have the Civil Rights Act passed lasted from literally the Supreme Court, essentially nullifying much of the 14th Amendment, all the way up to 1964 when Lyndon B. Johnson signed it into law. Now, when Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act into law, the Democrats claimed there was that at some point between there and Nixon that there was a great switch. By a great switch, what the Democrats mean is that they all got up from their desks and the Republicans all got up from their desks, and they must have been very equal in representation at the time because they changed sides. The Democrats took all of the Republican desks, the Republicans took all of the Democrat desks, and what the Democrats did is they left all of their hoods and robes for the KKK in their desks, and then the Republicans put them on and they completely reversed on racism or some ludicrous thing like that. That's the story anyway, is that there was this great switch in 1964, shortly thereafter, and that the Democrats and the Republicans all switched on their position on racism. The racists in the South joined the Republican Party, and they talk about a guy named Lee Atwood, who was an advisor to Ronald Reagan, and they refer to a interview that he gave in which he discussed the Southern strategy. Now, the way that you generally hear this is that Lee Atwater was discussing Ronald Reagan's Southern strategy of utilizing words, you know, not the N-word or anything that blatant, but saying things like, I'm against busing, or saying things like, subtly saying, I'm a racist and you should vote for me because I'm going to keep oppressing black people. That's the stories that Ronald Reagan, also Richard Nixon initially, but then Ronald Reagan, it was Ronald Reagan's campaign advisor, Lee Atwater. And so some of the things that he said were taken out of context to be applied against Nixon, who ran a very hard on crime platform when he was elected, and then Reagan. But that's actually a lie. If you listen to the entire conversation, and it wasn't an interview, it was a recorded conversation between three men. If you listen to the full conversation, Atwater said that politicians in the 50s could get the Southern vote by using racial slurs. And at that time, racial slurs began to hurt campaigns of those who used them, so the candidates in the 50s would begin to soften and change their language, taking in more nuanced but still racist terms about being against the Civil Rights Act or about being against busing or whatever. Lee Atwater then went further and said that racism was not a big issue in the South at all anymore. This was at 1981, the time that he had the conversation, and that candidates had to focus on things like national defense and sound economic policies to win in the South, just as they did in the North. So the Southern strategy was not Lee Atwater saying, this is what Nixon did and this is what Reagan did. No, it wasn't that at all. The Southern strategy is what Lee Atwater said stopped working, allowing Nixon and then Reagan to win in the South. The other problem with the concept of the Southern strategy is that there was no great switch in 1964. If we look at when the African-American population began voting predominantly Democrat, the first time they voted more than 70% Democrat was in 1936 when Franklin Delano Roosevelt ran for re-election. And an interesting story there, Franklin D. Roosevelt put in place the first minimum wage law in the country. Most people don't know what the purpose of the first minimum wage law was. But if we go all the way back to ancient Rome, Emperor Trajan had the first minimum wage in recorded history. If there was one earlier, it wasn't recorded. So we give Emperor Trajan credit for creating the first minimum wage. What he was doing when he created the minimum wage is he was listening to the will of the Roman citizens. Large numbers of people who were not Roman were moving to the city of Rome for work because they could make more in Rome than they could make where they came from. And because the Romans preferred to hire Romans over non-Romans, the non-Romans would have to work for less than what the Romans were willing to work for. So if a Roman wants to make so many dollars, whatever, I forget what their currency was, it eludes me. I want to say denarii, but I'm not sure. I don't believe that's it. At any rate, though, if a Roman wanted to make a certain amount of money that a non-Roman would offer to work for a little bit less than that, and then business owners began to notice that they could become richer if they hired non-Romans first because the cost of non-Roman labor was lower. Now, over time, as more businesses began to realize they could get more money if they first hired the non-Romans, the Roman people began to get upset because it began to look like them, like these non-Romans were displacing them from their jobs. So they went to Emperor Trajan, and Emperor Trajan was told, you know, we've got to do something about this. And what Emperor Trajan came up with is the minimum wage. What he said is you have to pay at least this amount to hire anybody, whether Roman or not, for this job and this job and this job and what have you. And what he did is he effectively priced the non-Romans out of the workforce by saying that if you're going to hire anyone, you have to pay an amount that a Roman is willing to work for. The effect of the first minimum wage law was to suppress non-Roman labor in Rome at the benefit of the Roman citizens in Rome. And when FDR decided to put in place a minimum wage law, what he was reacting to was that in the 1930s, leading up to the 1930s, but in the 1930s, it really became a much larger swell of people. You know, this was during the Industrial Revolution. You had large swaths of African Americans moving from the South into the North, looking for factory jobs, better lives for themselves, more opportunities for their children, and what have you. And when they got there, prior to this, there was no segregation in the North. It was unheard of because you might have a school with, you know, two black people in it in the North. And there was really no separation between the black kids and the white. Everybody was treated the same because there weren't that many black people in the schools. And there was no real difference in culture or anything like that. You know, and so the people just treated them like people, which is, of course, what we want to see happen. But when African Americans began moving into the North in greater numbers, we saw the population in the North do something very similar to what we see the population of the United States do whenever we have large numbers of immigrants coming from south of the border, which is to become afraid that this is going to start to affect their wages. It's going to make it harder for them to find jobs. And I'm not going to say there is absolutely no truth to that. What I would say is that the problems of having unlimited immigration from countries with vastly different cultures, with different cultures than ours, doesn't really relate to economics or to people taking jobs or to how much. In the short term, yes, it can have a downward effect on wages. But in the long run, that goes away as these people, the immigrants, they grow in wealth, they buy more things, and they just grow the economy over time. So in the short term, yes, there can be a suppression of wages, but it doesn't last. Once the immigration, it slows down into a regular pace. Now, the pace we have right now is ridiculous. So, yeah, that's causing major problems, not just with wages, but in other areas too. But overall, now, immigrants don't, they're not bad for the country. They're not bad for your pocketbook. So that's just, as a general rule, we're in a special case at the moment, but as a general rule, immigrants are a wonderful thing for the country if they're coming in at a pace that the country can absorb. But people get afraid of that. You know, it's natural to think, you know, this is going to hurt me, so I need to have it stopped. So in the 1930s, people in the North were very upset about all of the African Americans that were coming up and offering to work in factories for jobs that before that white people had been working for a little bit less money. And they went to FDR, and FDR's solution was the same one as Emperor Trajan's. He put in place a minimum wage and prevailing wage laws that guaranteed that anybody you hired was going to have to make the wages that white people were willing to work for. And of course, the effect of that was immediate. African Americans, before that law was passed, actually had a lower unemployment rate and a higher workforce participation rate than white people did, meaning that they were working in, as a percentage of their overall population, they were working in larger numbers, and they were getting hired ahead of white people. Now, they were making less, that's true, for the same jobs, but that pay gap was closing. And it was closing because they were being hired first. And anytime you have one form of labor that is favored over another, the cost of that form of labor is going to grow. So the African Americans were being hired first because they were cheaper, but that was making them less cheaper over time. So what happened is Democrats still at the time being the party of racism. And when I say the party of racism, I mean this was a time in the country when African Americans walked into the Democratic National Convention every 4 years. The KKK went in full regalia. So they marched right into the DNC every 4 years in full regalia. So that's the Democrat Party we're talking about in the 1930s. Still very, very much the KKK's party. And FDR, he passed the minimum wage law, and it had exactly the effect it was intended to, which was to get a bunch of African Americans unemployed and get all the companies hiring white people again. It had exactly the effect that it was intended on. Now, that happened, in spite of that, the African-American community, because of other things FDR did in relation to welfare and what have you, that the Democrats were able to sell as benefiting the African-American community. And you got to love the logic of this. First, we're going to use minimum wage laws to take your job away so that you are destitute, and now we're going to support you. How nice of us. Whatever the case, with control of a lot of control of the media, they were able to sell this well enough that 70% of the African American vote in 1936 did vote for FDR, and the Democrats have gotten at least 70% of the African American vote in every single election since, in spite of the fact that they're the party of slavery, Jim Crow, and the minimum wage law. The other part of this that the Republicans, that the South went to Republicans right after 1964, that's also not true. The fact of the matter is that the last Democrat to win the South was Jimmy Carter in 1976. The South didn't go Republican until 1980, which is almost 20 years. You know, it's 16 years after the passage of the Civil Rights Act. So the timetable for this great switch, it doesn't even line up. It doesn't line up on the African-American vote switching. It doesn't line up on the South switching. And that was Lee Atwater's point. Lee Atwater's point was that as racism receded in the South, which it did for a number of reasons, in a free country, racism tends to recede over time because free people tend to interact for mutual benefit, and racism is stupid. So it tends to go away over time in a free society. America being a very free society at the time, not only was racism dissolving in the South on its own slowly, but also you had people moving around. You had people from the North that were moving South. You had people from the South that would move North. And as you have these migrations of people within the country, of course, that also affects the country's politics and the country's attitudes toward race. So as racism receded in the South and the South became more interested in the same sorts of things that were interesting in the North at the time, which was, we want to have the police protecting us, but not harassing us. We want to have freedom. We want to have, we want to have all these things. The South did become more Republican. At the same time, the Democrats, claiming that there had been a great switch, began to spend a tremendous amount of time and effort in our big cities trying to convince people that Republicans were now the party of racism. And there was kind of a switch where it wasn't the North went Democrat and the South went Republican. It wasn't like that at all. It was more that in metropolitan areas, you began to see more of a focus on Democrat politics because of welfare and things like that. And in more rural areas, they became Republican centers because that's where things are produced. You kind of look at it not just in terms of city and country, but you can look at it in terms of consumer and producer. You have a lot of jobs, obviously, in New York City, Chicago, whatever, but they're more service-oriented jobs in terms of banking, in terms of retail, et cetera, et cetera. Not a lot of factories in New York City. Not a lot of farmland on Long Island. So the production tends to occur outside of the cities, but the consumption primarily occurs in the city where the population bases are. So you can look at it in terms of Democrats who always offer to subsidize consumption by taxing production versus Republicans realizing that if you tax production too much in order to subsidize consumption, you're going to make production unprofitable and people will stop producing. That, by the way, is the true story of Venezuela. It collapsed because production became too expensive and the companies just stopped producing. The idea that it collapsed because we wouldn't support it, what an argument that is. Socialists will actually look you in the face and say that socialism would work great if the capitalists would just feed them. Well, if socialism worked, you wouldn't need the capitalists to feed them. That's just an absurd argument. Argument made all the time, indirectly anyway. Nobody will put it in those words, but that's the basic argument. So anyway, the concept of the Southern strategy is just, it's silly. It never happened. It's a complete lie, a complete fabrication. And, you know, in 1968, Nixon did really run on a promise of law and order. And Democrats said, well, running on law and order, you know, that's nuanced racist terms. Well, is it? If law and order is a nuanced racist term, that's kind of like saying that black people are criminals. And black people at the time, Nixon was saying this, were not criminals. Milton Friedman predicted that crime would start becoming more prevalent in the big cities because of the war on poverty. And we're going to get that in the second part of our show. But the whole concept that running on law and order when crime was not a major problem in any race in the country is absurd. Yeah, listen to read some of the stuff Thomas Sowell has written about what it was like growing up in North Carolina, in New York, as a black man under Jim Crow, and how safe it was. How white people could go into black areas and go to bars. Nobody cared. Everybody, I don't want to say everybody got along. There was a lot of racism in the United States at the time. There's still racism in the United States. But the picture that we are given reality is often more complicated than we're told that it is. Thomas Jefferson, for example, is today remembered primarily, at least on the left, as a slaveholder. That's the big thing they focus on. Thomas Jefferson owned slaves, never freed Sally Hennings, owned slaves. That's true. Thomas Jefferson also got within two votes as the governor of Virginia before the Constitution was ratified. He got within two votes of getting Virginia, the largest state, slaveholding state in the country at the time, to ban slavery. Two votes. He wanted to ban slavery throughout the state, got within two votes of doing it. Thomas Jefferson also, as president of the United States, banned the importation of new slaves into the country. So yes, he was a slave owner. He was also an abolitionist. Now, why couldn't he free his own slaves? Because his own slaves were in hock. He was in debt. His slaves were his greatest asset in terms of value. So guess who really owned the slaves? They were owned by the banks. And this was true for most plantations. The plantation system was one of borrowing large sums of money in the spring to plant, or before spring to plant, and then hopefully being able to pay all of that off in the fall when you harvest it. That was a big part. That was the financial aspect of the plantation system. And you know, you could always go a little further out, go over the Appalachian Mountains and get new land. So land wasn't that expensive. As a consequence, land was not the best asset that they had to borrow against. Unfortunately, and I'm just being honest here, I'm just giving you the truth. The primary asset the plantations had that they could borrow against were their slaves. So that was why Thomas Jefferson couldn't get rid of his slaves, was because he owed money on them and he couldn't sell them. He couldn't free them. He had to pay them off first, and he wasn't able to do that. So we'll get into the whole second part about how the war on poverty is such a big part of this in a moment. But first, I'd like to talk about health. Metabolic dysfunction affects 87% of Americans, yet most people have never even heard of it. According to the NIH, this is when metabolic health markers like cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, or weight are out of whack. Often there is no symptoms, but left unattended, we become inundated with one health problem after another. HealRight is a ready-to-eat metabolic health bar with a synergistic blend of superfood ingredients to address nutritional root cause of metabolic dysfunction in as little as 8 weeks without additional diet or lifestyle changes. HealRight is not just effective, it's also delicious and works without additional diet or lifestyle changes. No more worrying of the side effects of medications and figuring out how to stick to difficult diet and lifestyle changes. It beats metabolic dysfunction. Foods can be your best medicine. It tastes like a treat, it acts like a medicine, but without the side effects that medicines can have. Step out of the statistics using food as a medicine. 7 in 8 Americans are metabolically unhealthy. 6 in 10 suffer from at least one chronic disease. This product, these bars, have 15 plus years of research developed by world-renowned nutritional scientists, and they have a 100% money-back guarantee. Each bar contains a synergistic blend of superfood ingredients needed to support metabolic health, including 20-plus essential micronutrients, vitamins, and minerals. It has soluble and insoluble fiber, 6 grams of it, for close to 25% of your total dietary fiber needs in just one serving. It's got plenty of omega-3 fatty acids, which is something I know I don't get enough of. My wife's always telling me to eat more fish. You get 6 grams of protein and other building blocks for metabolic health. They are antioxidants, high polyphenol-containing foods within these bars, and they only have 250 calories per serving, so though they're delicious, they're not a meal replacement. You get to eat the bar as a snack, you get to eat your regular meals all day. Try Heal Right today. Go to HealRight.com and use promo code OUTLOUD. That's HealRight.com, promo code OUTLOUD, for 20% off your first purchase. That's code OUTLOUD at HealRight.com. These bars are they're phenomenal. My wife and I use them. I've been able to wean myself off of not just my cholesterol medication, but everything that I was taking, except with Sinopril. I was taking 3 different blood pressure medications. Now I'm just down to 1. My wife has found that it helps her too. She agrees with me. Heal Right just works. So along with a diet, with a healthy diet and exercise, Heal Right can make all the difference in the world. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to give a moment for our sponsors. Don't go away. We got a lot to talk about on the other side on Cutting Through the Chaos in the America Out Loud Network.
The pandemic may be over for some, but millions of Americans are needlessly suffering from the long-term effects of toxic spike protein from COVID-19 and the vaccines. Fortunately, Dr. Peter McCullough and his team at The Wellness Company designed their spike support formula with the miracle enzyme natokinase, scientifically studied to dissolve spike protein, so you can feel your very best. Go to OutLoudCare.com today and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order.
You've all heard Dr. McCullough and others share over and over the value of keeping your sinuses cleansed. It's a smart move all year, but even more so when we're cooped up inside. It's not really open for debate any longer. Those that live smart and live well pay attention to nasal and oral hygiene. Cofix RX has just the tools for the job with our nasal and throat cleanse. Click the Cofix RX banner on AmericaOutloud.shop to get 20% off your entire order. That's right, AmericaOutloud.shop. Use coupon code OUTLOUD. That's coupon code OUTLOUD for 20% off your entire order.
Use Cofix RX because it works.
Cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, and weight. These are all real-world problems that 87% of Americans are struggling with. Fight back with Heal Right. Heal Right is a bar you eat, but it's food as medicine that addresses the nutritional root cause of health issues in just 8 weeks. Take action today. Visit HealRight.com/OutLoud or AmericaOutloud.shop and use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death and disability. Lifestyle changes are critical, but you can also support your heart with concentrated nutrients. Healthy Cell created Heart and Vascular Health to support cholesterol and blood pressure with CoQ10, vitamin K2, resveratrol, and soluble fiber. And Healthy Cell's not a pill. It's a patent-pending gel you swallow. Get heart healthy. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. HealthyCell.com, code OUTLOUD for 25% off.
The buildup of spike proteins is dangerous to your health. Global Healing's Foreign Protein Cleanse detoxes your body, removing the spike proteins, allowing your body to repair from within. Formulated by Dr. Edward Group and by Dr. Brian Artis, Foreign Protein Cleanse targets and detoxes spike proteins in the body. Go to AmericaOutloud.shop and get 15% off using the code OUTLOUD. Global Healing, giving you the power to take control of your health naturally.
A suppression of truth in a world of darkness, void of any soul, requires that we are rightly informed, properly equipped, and strongly motivated to fight the corruption. AmericaOutloud.news is that place to awaken your heart, soul, and mind to the out loud truth. Now is our time. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Cutting Through the Chaos of the American Out Loud Network. We were talking about the myth of the Southern strategy in the first half of the show. I want to talk about what I call American apartheid now in the second part of the show. This is a very, very important topic to me. I think that the war on poverty is probably other than slavery and Jim Crow themselves, probably the worst thing our country has ever done. We're in a very difficult spot today, separately from the war on poverty, in that now what we're saying is that if an African-American, or really any minority, says something, or a gay person, whatever, anybody who's supposedly a part of an oppressed group, if they say something that goes against the narrative put in place in our country, then we call them traitors to their group. You know, a race traitor, an Uncle Tom, if they're African American, whatever the case may be, we attack them for it, or the left does, not me. I don't attack them for it, but the country, many of the people on the left, they attack them for it, they ridicule them, and now, I've always said Thomas Sowell would have at least one and maybe two Nobel Prizes for the work he's done were he not an African-American. But because he's an African-American that is a conservative, the Democrats go after him with both barrels. You know, they don't even attack the things that he says, because that's hard to do. They attack him personally. I think today that is a major, major, major civil rights problem that minorities and people that are in supposedly oppressed groups are not allowed to think for themselves. And the reason they're not is actually very simple. I had an article about this fairly recently. The most important demographic in our country politically are single women, single white women in particular. When single white women show up to vote in large numbers, Republicans tend to win. Or excuse me, Democrats tend to win. When single white women stay home, Republicans tend to win. So getting single white women out to vote is very, very, very important to Democrats. As a consequence, we see the left pandering to the single white woman over and over and over again. And that plays its way itself out in everything on the left. If single white women think that African Americans can't get driver's licenses, then that is what the left focuses on. Oh my God, you can't force somebody to have a driver's license to vote because African Americans don't know how to get a driver's license as well. You know, all of this nonsense about black people can't do as well in school, black people can't do as well in standardized tests. You know, all of this garbage. It's racist, first of all. But the reason why this is what the left focuses on so much and then tries to make anybody, any minority or any oppressed group have to parrot exactly is because that's what the single white women voter seems to think. Not all of them, of course. There are single white women who are conservatives. But when you talk about large demographics, you're not talking about everybody, of course. You're talking about generalities. You're saying that the majority of them swing this way or the majority of them swing that way or whatever. We're talking generalities. I understand that. I'm not saying everybody in a demographic is the same way. What I'm saying, though, is that voting block drives the entire discussion on the left. And as a consequence, anybody that is considered a part of the left that does not toe the line, and of course, you know, if you don't know you're voting for me, you ain't black, as Biden said, they just attack anybody that doesn't fit the box they put them in. You go in this box, you try to get out, I'm just going to slap you around. You can't leave your box. To me, that's a very, very large civil rights act. There should be no boxes that individual groups of people have. You shouldn't be forced to sit in your box. You can't say this demographic, you go stand in that corner and here's your script. No, people should be free to think for themselves. They should be free to say what they think without fear of ridicule, without fear of being oppressed, without fear of being canceled. That crap got to stop. And it's all driven on the left. And it's driven that way because of the importance of just one simple demographic block. When they vote in large numbers, Democrats win. When they stay home, Democrats lose. It's also why they attack Donald Trump the way they do. They're attacking Donald Trump to make that resonates well with single white women. But, you know, we talked about the past of slavery in the United States. But I want to talk about it a little bit different now. I want to talk about 1964 when Lyndon B. Johnson moved from just passing the Civil Rights Act, which was a wonderful thing to do. It's important to note that it passed after the longest filibuster in U.S. history. Democrats held that thing up. They tried to prevent it from passing. It was the longest Senate filibuster in U.S. history. Democrats try and prevent the Civil Rights Act. LBJ eventually figured out, well, I can't prevent this from passing. So, as he put it, the N-words, and he did not say N-words, he actually used the N-word They're getting a little bit, his phrase he used was uppity, since we've got to give them a little something. Not a lot, just a little something to calm them back down. And what he said is, you know, go ahead and vote for the Civil Rights Act. We're going to give that to them. We'll find other ways to hold them back. We're going to give that to them. And what he said is, I will force those, the N-word again, to vote Democrat for the next 100 years. Some people on the left will say that he never actually said that because it was never written down. Well, he didn't write it in a book. He said it. He said it in front of a number of witnesses, and he really did say it. The Democrats said that he said it. Now, it wasn't like the Republicans there. It was there was his staff that heard it. So, you know, it really doesn't make much sense to say he didn't say it. He really did say that, as horrible as that is, and as much as that should make people think twice about whether or not he really had African-Americans' interests at heart when he passed the Civil Rights Act. Now, there were two things that were true in 1960. Detroit had its last Republican mayor, and Detroit was the richest city on earth. 1960, shortly before the Civil Rights Act. African-Americans, before the Civil Rights Act, were closer in parity to white people in the country than they had ever been before in our past, and they were on the verge of catching us. I told you how terrible the minimum wage was. Well, they didn't really keep the minimum wage moving between 1933 and the 1960s, when Lyndon B. Johnson radically increased the minimum wage. So what happened was the prevailing wages people actually got paid had grown beyond the minimum wage. So like right now where I live, the minimum wage is still just $7.35 or $7.45 an hour, whatever the federal minimum wage is. Michigan, I don't think, has a higher minimum wage. And even if Michigan does, it's not much higher. But the point is, you can't find anybody willing to work for less than maybe $13, $14, $15 an hour. I can go to McDonald's down the street and get $15 an hour. So nobody's willing to work for the minimum wage, and nor does anybody have to. Businesses are forced to pay much more than minimum wage right now in Michigan to find workers. Well, it was like that in the 1960s, where the minimum wage was below the wage that cleared the labor force. And the last person looking for a job gets hired, and that's the lowest wage anybody's going to get. So we don't really need a minimum wage, is the point there, because if we don't have a minimum wage, that doesn't mean businesses don't pay people. They can't find people willing to work below a certain level. They have to pay what people are willing to take. And right now, what people are willing to take in this area is about $15 an hour. It's lower or higher maybe in other parts of the country. But so if you look at anything from before Lyndon B. Johnson started the war on poverty compared to today, look at any statistic you want, any economic metric you want, you will see that African Americans as a group, again, not all individuals, we're not talking about individuals, we're talking about groups, we're talking about averages, we're talking about talking about that. You will find that African Americans as a group are on average worse off based on any economic metric you choose to use today than they were before the war on poverty started. Now, I go to the war on poverty. Some people would say before the Civil Rights Act. I choose to use the war on poverty, though, because the Civil Rights Act didn't hurt anyone. The Civil Rights Act was a wonderful thing. Shouldn't have been necessary. The 14th Amendment should have been the Civil Rights Act. But the Civil Rights Act should have passed. It did pass. We should all be very happy that it passed. The war on poverty, on the other hand, Milton Friedman looked at it, and he said, you know, this is going to destroy the country over the next 60 years. Well, the first thing that's going to happen is that African-American men don't have jobs with this package. Women, they can get welfare. You'll take care of them if they have kids. But African-American men, you're going to force them out of the household because the wife doesn't get any money if he's there. And they're not going to have any economic opportunity at all in large numbers. So, of course, that is going to drive them to crime. Got to throw a Republican on the bus a little bit here. Crack cocaine became a major problem in the 1980s. Jesse Jackson and some of the other so-called black leaders. I say so-called because the black people don't. It's not like anybody has the right to speak for an entire community. You have the right to speak for yourself, and that's all you have the right to speak for. I could say I'm a leader of the white community. That doesn't mean anything. I am not. I am a leader of me. And you are a leader of you. And that's true irrespective of whether you're black, whether you're white, whether you're some other race, whether you're gay, whatever you are the spokesperson for yourself. So when I say so-called black leadership, that's what I mean. I mean so-called. They call themselves that. Well, they asked Reagan to do something about crack cocaine. They wanted him to crack down on it, and he did. It was, in retrospect, it was a pretty big mistake because when cracking down on that, you know, that took a lot of African Americans and put them in jail and in prison. And in prison, you know, they come out, now they're felons, they have a felony record. So that exasperated some of the problems the war on poverty had initially caused. I don't believe Reagan did that on purpose. A lot of people today say that he did. The truth is he was doing that at the behest of Jesse Jackson and other members of the so-called Black American leadership. But even without that, when we look at the effects of the Civil Rights Act, it has just been absolutely devastating to African American community. Milton Friedman didn't actually call it the war on poverty. He called it the war on Black people, and he predicted that after it rose crime rates and over a few generations, what happened is crime would become normalized in the inner cities amongst the Black community. And when I say amongst the Black, really it became inner city, period. It's people living in the inner city, large, you have gangs there, and crime has largely been normalized within parts of the inner city. And when crime becomes normalized, people begin to think that the police are not enforcing the law so much as they are oppressing the people that are breaking the law. And since breaking the law is now normalized, people begin to resent having police officers enforcing the law. And so then you start getting rioting and all kinds of other things. Now, there was rioting in the 60s and early 70s that was not related to this. That was rioting related to racism. You know, just as we saw with George Floyd. And I was just a baby in the 70s, so I don't remember all the specifics of what caused those riots. But I know the George Floyd riots were largely caused under false pretenses. I don't think the pretenses were necessarily false in the late 60s and early 70s. I think people expected cultural change maybe to happen earlier or faster than it actually did when the war on poverty or when the Civil Rights Act passed. And I think that when the war on poverty began to systemically oppress the African-American community, really anybody in the inner cities, but that was predominantly African-Americans at the time, you started to have, obviously, when you have large numbers of people unable to work that are accustomed to being able to work, they feel oppressed, they start becoming very resentful, and that's a recipe for riots. The thing about riots, though, is if you maintain law and order, if you put the riots down, they don't destroy the city. It is the cities in America where the riots were not put down. That's where you saw, you know, what people call white flight. And let's be clear, was it white flight? Well, yes, white people moved out into the suburbs. That wasn't necessarily because they were white. A lot of that was because they could afford to. A lot of African Americans, if they had money, they moved out also. So it wasn't just white people moving. It was really wealth flight. Wealth flight at the time being, unfortunately, mostly white. But if you look at the cities that are poor today, like Detroit, 1960, it's the richest country in the world. 1980, not so much. You look at other cities around the country, you pick the cities where that are the most impoverished today, that have had the most problems today with businesses leaving, the Rust Belt, all of that. Compare the cities that prevented rioting in the late 60s and early 70s with the cities that are doing well today versus the cities that are bombed out, you know, the Detroits of today. Just do I'm not going to do it for you. Do that yourself. When you have a little bit of time, compare them. What you'll find is that by and large, it's the same list of cities. So allowing rioting, that causes a lot of that wealth flight. And then when you have the wealth flight, the next thing that happens is the property tax or the tax base starts to erode because now the money's gone. You don't have anybody to tax. And then what happens is any businesses that are left begin getting taxed too heavily because you don't want to tax the people that are still there. They don't have any money. So you have to tax the businesses. Well, that pushes the businesses out. In addition to that, look at our schools. Look at what the Democrats have done to our school systems. Now, where I live, we've got great schools. But if I go into Detroit, Detroit's got one of the worst school systems in the country. And it's not because it's not funded. They get more state funding than any other school system in Michigan. So it's not a lack of funding. It's that the money gets spent in such a way that by the time it gets down to the students, there isn't any left. There's a lot of corruption there. And it's a terrible, terrible thing. But what we have done is we have destroyed the schools in our inner cities, particularly the ones that had problems with the race riots in the 60s and 70s. And then, you know, with the minimum wage laws, essentially what you're saying is you can hire kids that are not as well educated in the inner cities, or you can move out to the suburbs where the white kids are. They're better educated, not because they're white, but because their schools are better. And for the same price, you can hire them. That's what happened. And that's why we're seeing what we're seeing today. But if we go back even before that, and this is the part that I think is going to be really, really eye-opening for you. If you flash back to South Africa after World War II, black South Africans were dominating many fields such as construction. Black South Africans, in fact, had a lower unemployment rate in South Africa than did white South Africans at the time. And black South Africans had a higher workforce participation rate than did white South Africans. Just like the United States before right before the first minimum wage law. Same thing was true. There was a pay gap between black and white workers doing the same things in South Africa after World War II, just as there was in the north of the United States before the minimum wage law, but that gap was closing, as it had been in the United States in the north in the 30s. White labor unions were upset, though. They pressed for political reform to address what they considered to be a major problem, which is that black people were getting hired first. So guess what happened? South Africa passed laws ensuring that black South African schools would always be inferior to white South African schools. That was easy to do, by the way, because South Africa was a segregated society. And they passed minimum wage and prevailing wage laws to ensure that black South African workers were just as expensive but not as well educated as white South Africans. Just as the minimum wage in America oppressed African American labor, so too the reform South Africa used oppressed black South African labor, and they were in fact a central pillar of the economic side of apartheid. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't have any documentation of LBJ actually saying this, but I'm here to tell you, the war on poverty is the exact same set of policy prescriptions that the white South African trade unions asked for after World War II to oppress black South Africans. It's literally the exact same set of laws. So when we look at the war on poverty, what Milton Friedman called a war on black people, and he called it that before it was passed. He predicted exactly what was going to happen on the exact timetable it happened before it ever passed. Ladies and gentlemen, it's modeled after apartheid. We have a literal American apartheid in the United States today. It was enacted by LBJ, and it's still out there. And you know, the funny thing is that if you look at the list of richest ethnicities in the United States, now the only two groups that the Census Bureau actually keeps are those in Asia and those in South America. I don't know why they don't keep the Middle East. I don't know why they don't keep Africa. For whatever reason, these are the only two groups that they break out is in those terms. But if I go through those lists of the richest ethnicities in the United States, this is all ethnicities in Asia, South America, or from Asia or South America, I should say, and also, of course, white people. I'm going to list all of the richest ethnicities. The richest ethnicities in the United States are, excluding Africa and the Middle East, because there are some there that are probably wealthier than white people also. But here are the ones that are richer than white people. From Asia, the following groups: Indian, Taiwanese, Filipino, Pakistani, Chinese, Sri Lankan, Nepalese, Korean, Hmong, Japanese, Indonesian, Cambodian, Thai, Vietnamese, Bangladeshi, and Laotian. All of those ethnicities in the United States, people that are from those areas, that are from those ethnicities living in the United States, they are richer on average than the average white person. From South America, the following ethnicities are richer than white Americans: Argentine, Bolivian, Chilean, Uruguayan, and Costa Rican. There are also several African nations, such as Nigeria. I know this from Thomas Sowell. I don't know how many African countries this is true about. I know it's true about Nigeria. If immigrants that move from Nigeria on average have a higher income than the average white family, they have higher household incomes on average than do white families. Black American households whose ancestry comes from the Caribbean have a higher median household income than do white Americans. Now, those things change. It takes about three generations for generally speaking, for a new immigrant family's children and grandchildren, for their offspring to normalize, to come into more of an average, on average, American income level, household incomes. But that happens. It happens over time. Generally happens slower on the way down. When you look at Asian families in the United States, it generally takes more like five or six generations before they regress to mean and have average incomes. So obviously things that work, I guess it takes longer to change them than things that don't work. But if you look at America, you know, it's been 60 years since we brought out the war on poverty. We still have minimum wage laws, prevailing wage laws, affirmative action, and all of the other oppressive things that have been holding African Americans back. And here's the thing that I want you to understand about affirmative action. Now, I can take an African American in the 90th percentile in math, and I can put him in MIT because of affirmative action. But for a white guy to get into MIT, he's got to be in about the 99th percentile in math. What we're doing when we take black people and we put them into schools who would otherwise not get into because of affirmative action, what we're doing is we're pairing them with white people that do better on standardized tests than they are, and we're putting them in schools that they're probably not that good. You know, they're not going to be as successful at. A black kid in the 99th percentile in math at MIT is probably going to do just as good as a white kid in MIT in the 99th percentile in math. But if we take somebody who's not as good at math, MIT is a math-intensive school. They're probably going to struggle. And what affirmative action has done is it's made it easier for minorities to get into difficult schools by lowering the standards. So now you don't have to be one of the brightest to get in. But it's done it at the expense of them graduating. The dropout rate for people that get in because of affirmative action and not because of merit is very high. So what's happening is we're taking kids and we're saying, you know what? I'm not going to give you a degree, but I'll let you owe $100,000 to a good school. And now this kid's got, you know, he's 22 years old. He's got no degree. He dropped out of college and he still has to pay his student loans. Gee, isn't it nice to be him? Well, I'll tell you who it does help. Who it helps are the white liberals that get to look around them on college and say, look how diverse we are. Look what we're doing. We're allowing all these people. We're making this diverse. We're bringing people that would never be able to get into Harvard. Maybe they'd have to go to UCLA instead. And then the white liberals get to feel good about themselves because of how diverse these things are. And then other people get hurt. And I'm afraid my friends, just like that, we're out of time, but that's okay. We got through everything I wanted to cover. We talked about both the Southern strategy being a myth and also about American apartheid, the war on poverty. As always, thank you for tuning in. Please tell others who might be interested in cutting through the chaos to listen in either on Saturday and Sunday at 9 a.m. or on podcast whenever they have the time. It's 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, or on podcast whenever they have time. And we will see you next week at the same time and place, where it will once again be time to get loud and get involved on America Out Loud.